Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today we want to talk about something fairly serious, but something that we've been, Dr. Sherry Siegel in the studio with me, something that nobody talks about. It came to my attention from an email I received from someone recently who talked about the unfortunate suicide of her husband when she wasn't suspecting it and how she had to deal with it. After seeing that, it just kind of stirred my thoughts. How often does anybody ever talk about suicide itself? And what is suicide? What is this thing? Well, no sooner do I do that than I look in the newspaper, and Sherry, welcome to the program back again, as usual.
Hi, Armand.
Suicide, right? What's happening in India?
Oh, shocking and surprising information comes from the south of India, where the suicide rates are some of the highest in the world. Young people, students who believe in political movements, are actually taking their lives to, for example, claim that a state should become a state on its own, an area in southern India should become its own state. And suicide's not new to India. Even though Hinduism forbids it, suicide has taken place in India. And young people see this as a way to give meaning to what they see as meaningless lives. In the past, we think of Gandhi and his fasts, and that there were ancient warriors called the Tamil Nadu, also in the southern part of India, who would commit suicide if their commander was killed.
So let's slow this down for a moment. What is suicide? What is it? According to, it comes from the Latin suicidare, which is to kill oneself. It's the act of willfully ending one's own life. So if I look at somebody who is a bomber in Russia who decides to kill themselves and take a bunch of people with them, is that suicide? Well, according to the definition, they are willfully taking their own lives. But if they are convinced that this is a higher thing, a more powerful thing, does it still fall under suicide?
It's a difficult, as a clinician, sometimes to tell when someone is so ill because of their depression or so in such deep, intense pain that their faculties are muddled as a result of these illnesses, and because hopelessness is a part, an integral part of depression, it's very difficult sometimes to help someone who is in the depths of that depression, in the depths of intense pain, to understand that there is hope for them.
Well, that's not our job, though. The first point is, if suicide a person's right, is it something they do? I don't even talk about helping them yet. The first point I want to do is define this. Are the people in India, do they need help? I mean, I don't know if they need help. Maybe they just want to... See, we can't talk about this. We're not allowed to talk about it unless we talk about it as saviors of suiciders. And that's always been the limiting factor. The limiting factor is every doctor who's ever gotten on the air has got to be afraid that they're going to condone suicide in some way because they're going to get sued, because somebody's going to point a finger at them and say, yeah, you said suicide was okay. So what we have is a huge number of people attempting suicide badly, of which, I don't know what the statistic is, but I'm sure we'll find it, only 1 in 20 people who try to commit suicide actually do it, and the rest, some of them are left crippled for the rest of their lives by the damage that they did to themselves in their attempt. Some people live with broken necks, some people live with, you know, poisoned bodies. But because you're not allowed to talk about it, because we can't, because we as clinicians, as soon as we hear it, we have to ring a bell. There are people I know who have asked me, they wanted to see a psychiatrist. And I would say, why? And they would say, because I felt like killing myself. And I knew what would happen. The minute they called a psychiatrist to make an appointment, if someone said, why? And they said, because I felt like killing myself, the psychiatrist wouldn't see them. They would not see them because they don't want to be exposed to somebody who could hold them responsible for not preventing the suicide once they mention it? So it becomes, if you are considering, or if anybody considers ending their lives, we have this kind of judgment that says not allowed to talk about, not allowed to talk about it, therefore driving it into secrecy, therefore creating even more damage. So look what happens in India. In India, we have a whole bunch of kids who are saying, let's stop ourselves now. We think it's a noble gesture. This is young people. And young people are likely to act on impulse this way, which we'll report later. But then you look at someone like Gandhi, who says, I will fast until death, unless you allow free transport of the salt, whatever it was he was fasting about. Until death. Is that suicide? It doesn't look like suicide. All right, let's move to the Buddhist monks during the Vietnam War, self-immolation. We will set ourselves in fire in a dramatic way of showing you what you're doing. Japan, Harikari. I am going to, rather than shame, live with shame, I will kill myself. And it is a noble death, or even in the airplanes with the people who are the dive bombers, you know, and it's like another way. This is a noble death. And here we are also in a world where people of Islam are saying this is part of the way we live beautifully. We will blow ourselves up if we have to. So is it worth looking at this concept, this idea? Or should we just roll it under the rug because we're afraid to talk about it? Because if we do, somebody's going to point a finger at us and say, ah, you see, you're helping people commit suicide. We are beyond that. So Sherry and I, Sherry, who's being at least as brave as I am, perhaps far more brave, you say, let's jump in there. Let's talk about this because people are getting hurt.
Well, we need to speak about it. If we don't put it on the table, we can't intervene. Well, and, you keep talking
about intervene. Mm-hmm. Let's hold that for a while, okay. Will you? Because you just keep talking like that's our job.
When I took the Hippocratic Oath,
yes. What is the Hippocratic Oath?
I couldn't say it word for word, but it basically said that we need to help people who are ill and intervene when we can. So the
intervene with what?
With medicines and treatments.
So therefore, if a person considers suicide, it automatically means that you have to stop them.
If you believe in the Hippocratic Oath, and also in most states in the United States, physician-assisted suicide is not legal. And so, yes, one would say that intervention to prevent suicide is what a doctor should do. It's also important to address the causes of the hopelessness. If I don't do that, then if I don't address the pain, for example, when pain is overwhelming, if I don't address the hopelessness in someone who has depression, then I'm not doing my job. But there are people in some of the states in the United States, in the Northwest, who believe that it's perfectly reasonable to help someone who wants to end their life.
So we go back to this issue where three times I'll say to you, well, let's talk about suicide. And you say, yeah, because we got to prevent it. And I say, let's move away from the we got to prevent it. Because that's the head that is stopping us from seeing it. This idea that it is to be prevented. I agree. I would hope people wouldn't hurt themselves. I would rather people stayed around because I think there are teachers. But if we keep throwing in this, oh, but you got to, I think we lose sight of it. So let's see if we could take it. Like, look at what's happening in France. What's happening in France? In France, suddenly there's this breakout, right, which they're talking about. I'm going to read you an article. It says, something is amiss in the land of leisurely lunches and the six-week paid vacations, which is the beauty of France. And the French, known for their joie de vivre, are in a crisis after a series of job-related suicides at several top corporations. Now, the corporate leaders many of them who have fallen by the wayside because of the economy, many of them have offed themselves. But then they found that there's a suicide spree also among teenagers in France. So now people are all looking at this and they're saying, it's too much. It's too much. If it's just job-related, you know, then why aren't there these many in Greece? You know, with Greece having such a high rate of unemployment. If it's unemployment causing it, but it's not. There's something happening in people's perception of their own lives. You know, Sherry, I sometimes wonder about, and you know much more about this with dementia, and as you see it, part of the beauty of dementia, I think, the beauty of dementia, is that you don't consider, in real dementia state, killing yourself. Is that right?
It really depends on the stage of the dementia. Sometimes early dementia.
No, but in a later stage.
In the later stages, people have less connection with their own abilities. In most ways, they really need help to do most things, and their thinking becomes simplified. They don't have a big overview thinking. They just kind of think what's in front of them. Food is in front of them. They eat it. Going to the bathroom is in front of them. They go to the bathroom. So they're much more in the moment.
Look at nature's design. Nature's design used to be, hey, you get a little older. You go through having babies. You no longer are going to have babies. Go walk out onto the ice, right? You know what I'm talking about in Alaska. The Eskimos would go walk out onto the ice, and this is the way they'd end their life, with hypothermia, a decent way to go, right? But the elder, who must have been 40 years old at the time, said, well, my life is done. It's time for me to leave. Well, now people have learned to live beyond those years, and what nature has done is taken away their ability to go out on the ice. So they're kind of sitting around because there's a change in our perception about this. So we have to learn a lot about this willful taking of your life and feelings about it, and try to do it without the panic of, we got to stop everybody, we got to stop everybody. Because I don't know if we have to stop everybody. I think we have to let people take a look and see. Now, why? Why would I even say that for a moment? I would say that because every 18 minutes, someone in the United States kills themselves. A few are younger than 10 years old. Others are over 90. Between 7.5, well, about 10% of them take more than a day to die after they try to kill themselves. An estimated 300,000 to 600,000 survive suicide attempts, but suffer varying degrees of injury. 19,000 people are permanently disabled in the United States every year by their attempt at suicide. And only one in about 10 or 20 suicides, one in about 15 suicides, are fatal. Given the easy availability of these high legal methods, it seems that suicide attempters don't want to die because guns are available, knives are available, ropes are available. It seems that all of these attempts are not really attempts to die.
Sometimes they're cries for help. So we call those suicide attempts. And those are very serious. Sometimes they do lead to people may want to truly take their lives, and they do. People who attempt suicide have a higher percentage of accomplishing suicide. But when someone makes a suicide attempt, we treat it as a life-threatening illness. And as a physician, my colleagues and I usually intervene. Now, it's different from the point of view that you're taking about allowing someone to commit suicide.
No, I'm not saying we should allow someone. I'm saying we should take off the automatic connection is we got to stop it and see if it's possible to think about it with an open mind. Because the minute I know what my license says I have to do, if someone calls and said I'm thinking of killing myself, I go, oh, I got to give them an immediate appointment because somebody would criticize me if I don't. And I remember a man who came to me once and he said, Armand, I want to talk about killing myself. In fact, I think it was on the radio he did that. And he said, if I came to see you, would you have to report me to the police? You know, and legally, there was some kind of part of me that had to at least advise people that he was in danger. And he said, I want to talk to somebody about this, but I don't want to be sent to the police.
Sometimes a person like that can go to the be recommended to go to the emergency room, or taken by ambulance even, or taken by a colleague or a friend to the emergency room, where physicians are there to help, psychologists, therapists are there to help address the issue.
Well, wait a minute now. They would help address the issue by trying to prevent it. You're back to it.
Yes.
You see how your mind swung right back into that? This man didn't want to talk to anybody about it. He wanted to talk about it, not because he was despairing, because he was considering it an option.
Mm-hmm. I think my first inclination as a human being is to first say, why would you want to take your life? And to understand that thoroughly, and to wonder, why have you come to the end of your hope?
If it's the end of hope. Once again, I'm claiming that it is the thinking that it is the wrong thing to do that inhibits us from learning about it. We have to learn about it. Why do you want to have a baby when you're 14 years old? Why? Many kids do. Many young girls are walking around hoping they can become pregnant so that they could have a baby when they're 14. I know it's not the right thing to do, but how am I going to learn about them if I don't come from a different place other than you shouldn't do it?
Mm-hmm. And there's a whole group of people. Some of them call themselves the Hemlock Society. And they are people who believe that suicide is a personal right. And they actually have, there are books that are available for ways to help someone who wants to take their own lives.
Suicide attempters can be put into one of four groups. Number one, rational people facing an insoluble problem, generally a fading or debilitating illness. You got something that's killing you. It's cancer to the bone. It's brain cancer. You got those things. Sherry, you know more than anybody else. Not more than anybody else, but you know a lot. The pain. You're a pain reliever in many ways. There are pains that you just can't get past, right?
That's true.
And the pain is so excruciating that if it was your brother, you'd say to him, you'd whisper over to him, listen, here's what you should do. Is that true or not?
No question.
You wouldn't say to him, no, you shouldn't kill yourself.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily suggest that they take their lives, but there are methods that can help alleviate the pain. The challenge with it is that it alters the person's consciousness. So when consciousness is altered, they're not really participating in the world, yet their pain is relieved. So it's a difficult
challenge. So you have, let's say, somebody you love is in this pain, right? And they're in this excruciating pain. And they say to you, Sherry, please, please let me leave. You know? Now, I know you can't legally say on air, you can't say, hey, of course, if it was my brother, I'd help them out. You can't say it. You're not allowed to. The law won't let you say it. But I know if it was someone that someone loved, they would, of course, want to make it easier rather than say, no, you got to lay in torment for the next 28 hours.
You know, it's a challenging question. Religious leaders and rabbis and priests talk about this issue, and they also attempt to answer these questions, because even if it's not concerning medical liability or healing, helping someone heal, there are religious questions that come up and questions of deep ethics. Mm-hmm. What is the right thing to do? It faces us not infrequently.
Now, of course, the reason why we were forced with this ethic is because our job is to keep people going. And that's why the ethic takes away people's choices. Yet we're seeing more and more people opting for this choice in one way or another, either as a religious thing, I'm going to kill myself, or as a part of jihad, I'm going to kill myself because I'm tired of living. Here are the four groups of people. The rational people facing an insoluble problem, generally a fatal or debilitating illness. Now, that's brutal, right? We know that could be really terrible. Second one is impulsive people, frequently young, truly but temporarily miserable, sometimes people, and it happens a great deal when you consider, when you mix alcohol, specifically alcohol, with impulsivity. Now that you talked before about manic depressive illness. What happens with that around suicide?
Mm-hmm. Well, with manic depression or bipolar disorder, there are two swings of the mood. The low swing is the depression, and usually the depression can be so severe that the energy level is low, the ability to take initiative is not present. The other side of that spectrum is mania. And in mania, there is increased energy and there is increased turmoil, so that someone who has mania is at greater risk of taking their own lives in that stage, in that state, rather, the manic state versus the depressive state of bipolar disorder. And if you think about, you mentioned alcohol. When alcohol is involved, this alcohol can be a brain suppressant, but there are stages of brain activity, where the brain sometimes feels agitated, and when there's agitation, someone is more likely to hurt themselves.
A third person who might do it is what they call irrational people. Now, you could be, if you're schizophrenic and you're imagining things, and you're imagining things are persecuting you, and you're imagining things are trying to harm you, sometimes you just want out. So that's one. People might be drunk. You know, one of the things about being drunk, and I've heard more than one person talk about this, I'm going to drink myself to death, is there's a point where you hope, and you actually can do it, there is an alcoholic point at which you poison yourself with alcohol. You actually could do it by alcohol even before you pass out. That there is a way of trying to just, you know, alcohol takes away any inhibition. And all you can see is, let me do more of this, and let me do more of it, and let me do more of it.
Your executive functions are affected by alcohol. They're dropped, so your inhibitions aren't filtered the way they normally would be. And people with the disease of alcoholism, who are essentially addicted to alcohol or drugs or other substances, they are also at risk for suicide.
You know, today's a day when it would be interesting for us to take phone calls, but instead of taking phone calls, what we're going to do is you can send us an email as we speak, and if you have a comment about it or a question about it, send us an email, and while we're on air, we will fetch the emails. And you can send that to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, @thepositivemind.com. Armand@thepositivemind.com, because you may have something to say about it, but you may not want to say it on the air. And the difficulty with taking phone calls on the air is if someone gets on the air and says, I want to kill myself, then we have to jump to attention by state law. And we have to then cancel everything about the show and say, all right, let's take care of you. We have to take care of you. We have to take care of you. And it becomes like an almost obligation, which I think is not fair, because therefore people cannot learn about what this is all about. What happens to a teenager when a teenager is saying to themselves, I would rather die? What could it possibly be?
One of the reasons that teens are sometimes pushed to suicide is bullying. We've heard cases, there was just something on the news where a young woman had been bullied and committed suicide as a result. And then there's cyberbullying, so that people online bully others. And so suicide, especially with the isolation of cyber loneliness, being online and without really the connection to other people face to face, people are at risk.
You haven't known any teenagers in that group, have you?
I have not.
Yeah. Hey, Lauren Sykes is here. Lauren, have you known any kids who have committed suicide?
No, I don't.
Yeah. And what do you think it is? What do you think brings people there? Lauren Sykes is our psychological apprentice here in the studio. What do you think brings kids to that level?
Probably just not anticipating their future, just thinking in the moment, thinking that they feel horrible and miserable now, and not taking into account you never know what's going to happen in your life. So it could eventually get better, even though it's not positive now.
Oh, that's a very interesting perception, because one of the beautiful things about being young is everything is about the now. If your boyfriend jilts you, you feel like dying now. right? Everything is about now. I must have it. I must have that toy. I must have that thing.
Exactly.
So you're saying that there's something about the inability to project into the future that we get over time. And it's something to project in the future that makes you consider, well, I may as well just kill myself now.
Also, young people have an impulsivity that's due to really brain development. Their stage of brain development is the executive parts of their brains are really still myelinating and growing, and so the likelihood of a young person being impulsive and suicide sometimes can be an impulsive act, especially when substances are involved.
Throughout the world, about 2,000 people kill themselves every day. That's about 80 people an hour. 80 people an hour. In the United States, there are more than 80 deaths from suicide every day, 30,000 every year. You know, it's just like a fully loaded jumbo jet crashing every fifth day. From another perspective, you're more likely to kill yourself than be killed by someone else. There are more deaths by suicide than there are by homicide. Another estimated 300,000 or more Americans a year survive a suicide attempt. A majority have injuries minor enough to need no more than emergency room treatment. However, a huge amount of them, 116,000, are hospitalized. The average hospital stay is 10 days. The average cost is about $15,000 every time someone makes an attempt. So what happens with people is they try over and over and over again. About 1.4% of Americans end their lives by suicide. This is the eighth leading cause of death in the United States and ranks fourth in years of lost life. The largest increase in the last 30 years has been among the young people, age 15 to 24. What's happened that has created the kind of pressure that have made people decide they're going to leave earlier, that they can't tolerate it? And I believe it's the anxiety levels. I believe anxiety levels become intolerable, the pressures become intolerable. Men kill themselves at about four times the rate for women. Four times as many men kill themselves as women do. Around 3% of the adults make one or more suicide attempts. And there's a lot more than the numbers show because people cover it up. If somebody attempts suicide, there's some doctor who's going to cover up. There's a family who's going to cover up. There are a lot more. They figure it's about 300% underreported.
It's interesting how shame and guilt play a big part in suicide. And I think your point is really well taken, that that's the reason that families don't talk about it. It used to be that families wouldn't talk about disease. Disease is okay to talk about now. But suicide suicide attempts, there's a sense of shame and guilt on the part of the family in talking about that.
And it certainly makes people angry. You know, it makes you angry when somebody in your family does it, because in effect, you're doing it to you. And we have to talk about the way that people try to express their hostility through an attempt at ending their own lives. For adolescents, the attempt to fatality ratio is 50 to 1. But this average masks the fact that the death rate for boys is 100 times higher than for girls. 100 times higher. Young boys, and young boys especially around pubescence. Talk about anxiety and what that does to you. When we get back from our break, we're going to be continuing our discussion about this. It's something to learn about, my friends. In the studio with me, Dr. Sherry Quincy and Sherry Siegel. Sorry, that's my friend Sherry Quincy. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Go ahead, Sherry.
Welcome back to The Positive Mind. This is Armand DeMille, Sherry Siegel in the studio today. We're talking about suicide, a serious topic, but there's a lot to be learned about suicide. Some people are aware that suicide actually runs in families.
Good.
And there's a belief, and actually some studies that show that there's a genetic factor in suicides. In fact, one Amish community in Pennsylvania was studied. They found that only 4 families in this Amish community represented 16% of the total, representing 16% of the total Amish population, accounted for 73% of all Amish suicides. So it's clear by that, at least that photo, that quick look at the Amish society, that suicide can run in families. And you might think about the Hemingway family, that there were actually a number of family members, 5, who committed suicide in that family. So there may well be a genetic proponent, a component to suicide. And there are really many causes for suicide. I think the obvious ones are pain and stress, as we were talking about before. But crime, someone who wanted to escape punishment might take their lives.
That's interesting. Somebody who, you know, you would have to believe that you're going to be cooped up, you have to be somewhat claustrophobic, you have to imagine that you're going to be limited, and like you said before, shame. Shame for some people is so intolerable. So what kind of upbringing did you have where shame becomes so intolerable? Listen, so I feel shame. Did you ever feel shame? Shame is okay, it's a feeling, right? One day you're doing something and you get embarrassed, you know? And you get embarrassed and you feel shame, and no people see you doing something you thought you were doing in private. And you feel shame. But shame is okay. It's just a feeling. But for some people, shame is anathema. Shame is terrible. Shame will lead you to put a knife in your belly and disembowel yourself. Shame is such a horrible thing. I think that therein it shows a part of the weakness that comes up, the psychological overload that comes up with many of the people who do themselves in. Their minds are bent because they have this belief that there is anything, that it's not going to get better tomorrow. And the truth of it is, if you're ever at that point, it always gets better tomorrow. On some level, it gets better. On some level, there is something that there is there better tomorrow than there is today. But when you're at the bottom of that pit, and I'm not saying that's a reason to continue, it may get better just for a moment. You may still make that choice. But in the bottom of this thing, it's like there is no tomorrow. I believe that if somebody is just fully depressed, they don't do it. But I believe if they have depression mixed with anxiety, it's the anxiety that kills them. It's the anxiety that drives them forward. Among the people you were talking about to kill themselves, think about it, the Hemingways, of course. Sylvia Plath, of course, mm-hmm. Right? In fact, wasn't there, where's our poem? Here's a poem she wrote. No, this was Dorothy Parker. She wrote this poem. She said, "Razors pain you. Rivers are damp. Acids stain you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful. Nooses give. Gas smells awful. I may as well live."
it's a laugh with pathos.
Yeah.
It's a sad laugh.
So dying is an art like everything else, said Sylvia Plath. I intend to do it exceptionally well. This is, so of the people who have, Sid Vicious, you know, Virginia Woolf, Jim Jones and Adolf Hitler, both cult leaders, right, which you would see as an ultimate expression of power. I was always surprised that Saddam Hussein did not kill himself. Do you know what I mean? It was like, was he going to go through all of that? And there goes the connection where you could see, wait a minute, wait, he was executed. How did he ever get to the point of execution? Why would he have not stopped himself at some point? You know, why would he have not done it? What does that tell us about this? How could he live with that embarrassment that he went through and the shame that he went through and the humiliation that he went through and still lead himself right up to the last moment? So I'm curious about that, just as I'm curious about some of these people who are the white-collar crimes people who are, you know, shamed. How did they just go through and say, I could get through this? So shame is not enough of a motive. It's not enough. It's just not, that's not bad enough. It's not, you can humiliate somebody and they will not do this to themselves. It may be the gene you're talking about.
If someone's narcissistic, though, Armand, is it possible that they don't feel shame, that they feel completely in their right having done what they've done? Hurt people, maybe that's the way we see it, but maybe they see it in a different way.
Well, you bring another issue up, which is great. Thank you. The narcissist, in describing a narcissist, not the way most people would describe a narcissist, which is somebody who loves themselves. I think it's the opposite. I think a narcissist, by definition, is someone who dislikes themselves. Because narcissism is a love of a false self. You create a self that's not real. And what you do is you live that false self. The belief is that if you could live this false self, then you will be loved. So people are going to admire you. People are going to love you if you become this false self. So the true narcissist, I'm going to be so beautiful that people will love me. I am going to be such a star that people will love me. I'm going to get on stage and get acting jobs and people will love me. Somebody's going to love me. I'll be a good boy and people will love me. I'll be a fine person. I will donate my time. That's narcissistic stuff. Narcissistic could be either grandiose, as many people do, or it could be that you just give up, but you're still lost in the self that is trying to get loved, but you have no idea who you really are. Now, here's what happens, and this is what I believe you've hit on. When you have what's called a narcissistic wound, that is something that happens that makes you believe and proves to you that your image of yourself is not true. For example, I have a friend who was going to a reunion, and in the reunion there was a person was involved in it, and the person was nasty, and by accident she sent an email to the person who was the nasty person criticizing her. Well, this friend of mine is such a good person and such a good, decent human being that she couldn't believe that she was seen as being sometimes nasty. And she was, it crippled her. It humiliated her, made her feel terrible because it cracked through her image of herself. Or if you believe that you could be loved and you have a husband or a wife and you think you have this wonderful relationship with them and you think you're doing so well to get loved and then you find out they're cheating on you and it cracks you to the soul and people talk about how it ruined me, it wrecked me, it destroyed me, it broke my whole world. What it broke was your image of yourself. The image of yourself was that you will be loved if you behave right. And that it can't possibly be that you're not being loved because you're living an artificial self, because the fake you is what's being loved, not the real you. No greater threat, I believe, exists to a person's existence than a narcissistic wound. Some people built their entire lives on it. They just are, I am going to be this thing. This is who I am. I am the healthy person. I am the this. I don't want to be seen this way. And rather than have themselves seen as not being the image that they projected themselves to be, they would rather end their lives. It's too much. Because the crack, when it goes through this narcissistic self, it tends to shatter you all the way down to the inside, and you feel pain that you've been protecting yourself against your entire life through this narcissistic image. Therefore, I think the depth of the pain through a narcissistic wound brings you down to the core, where I believe is where people really want to end their lives. That's where I think the emotional pain is.
It's a complete rejection of oneself, of what one is living.
Of one's false self.
Of one's false self.
Of one's false self. In fact, I would be willing to say, and I will agree with you, that almost all suicide is a narcissistic endeavor. Meaning, but not a love of self. Meaning, an attachment to an artificial self. This is Armand DeMille with Sherry Siegel here at WBAI. We're talking about suicide. We're talking about it because nobody talks about it, because people aren't allowed to talk about it. Here's a quote from Irvin Stengel. He said, most people in committing a suicidal act are just as muddled as when they do anything important under suicide, emotional stress. Carefully planned acts of suicide are rare as carefully planned acts of homicide. He said, in effect, people who do it, they don't really plan for it. It's just like mostly impulsive. But again, the impulse is to get away from the pain.
What would turn someone from homicide to suicide, or from suicide to homicide?
What an interesting thing. Because it all is rage, isn't it? I mean, if we talk about narcissism, the rage is against the self. What self is it against? It's against the self that, well, no, it's not. The rage is against other people. Other people for not loving you. Yes, and what is homicide? Getting mad at people for not loving you. I mean, almost invariably, right? What is homicide? The most number of deaths are people who are killed by people they know. Right? And how does that usually result? As a result of something that was interpreted as a betrayal. So how could you be betrayed? Because you expected somebody loved you. Right? And they betrayed you instead. Highest rate of homicide is among people who were known to other people who felt betrayed. So I think there is a definite connection between the rage that you feel towards people and the rage that you turn on yourself. You know what always surprises me about it? What always surprises me about it is how you have to disconnect with the baggage that you leave behind when you do it. Because I think the ultimate punishment of other people is to have them feel responsible for your suicide. I should have. I wonder if you even think about that. Because, you know, when I think about people who have come to talk to me and they talk about suicide, I say to them, well, your kids have got to grow up knowing you killed yourself. And they say, yeah, I know, they'll get over it. I'll send them to you. And it's like, well, wait a minute, wait, that thing, what's the disconnect? You must be able to truly disconnect with even your family.
But if someone, Armand, has extremely low self-esteem and feels, who would miss me? Who could care that much? Basically, you know, once this is over, and I'm in such pain, I just need relief. I don't want to hurt them, but I have no other way of achieving relief. And so this is the direction I'm going to go in. And you know what? They'll have lives. They'll be fine afterward. So low sense of self-esteem, isn't that another way that they could look at that and not really punish the people that are around them?
Not see it as a punishment, not think of it as a punishment, but think of themselves as someone unimportant that it's not really going to have an effect. I wonder how you can make that disconnect. There's no single cause for which suicide can be directly attributed. Environmental factors, childhood upbringing, mental illnesses seem to play a large role. But they're saying that to some degree, diagnosable mental disorders are associated with 90% of suicide victims. Now, you had a very big question before about people who do it through religious reasons or not. You ask, well, you know, what shape are they in?
Right. For people who committed a terror attack with a suicide bomb, or because the monks you mentioned before, Are those people who feel very passionately about their political movement, but really have a predisposition for deep depression and suicidal depression that leads them to become vulnerable and put themselves in that very vulnerable state? Or is it truly brainwashing by those who convince them to commit the terror attack?
Well, you bring up another interesting issue. Here we go. This is going to be a little questionable, I'm sure. I am willing to make a bet that psychopathy, which is the inability to feel remorse, right? That's what psychopathy is. A psychopath feels no remorse. As opposed to all other psychology, which is most other disturbances, the difference between the two is the lack of shame. The psychopath probably would not kill themselves because they don't experience that level of shame. When you think about taxi driver, Remember Taxi Driver, right? De Niro, right? There was no shame. It was just like, this is the way I am. That's psychopath, that's psychopathy, they call it. So now I'm thinking about my question before. Well, why did Saddam Hussein not kill himself? Why do certain people not kill themselves? Well, perhaps it's because they're psychopaths. And because once you have that kind of pathology, you're immune to it. Whereas if you have all the other pathologies, you feel the guilt and the shame, and you want to end your life. Here are a number of the reasons, the factors that are related. Here's one. Pain, of course, there's a physical and emotional agony that is not correctable. Stress. Stress is murder. I mean, I know people now with housing stresses and houses, that things that they've done to prepare themselves, that have all the plans have fallen apart. I know people in retirement who have lost their retirement money, you know. I mean, I see people under tremendous stress. It's amazing how people, I knew, when I worked in Wall Street many, many years ago as a kid, there was a man I remember who had $1 million, which was at the time, to me, the biggest amount of money that it was imaginable. And he had some options on a company, on a stock, a derivative, and he made his $1 million turn into $10 million. And then something happened in the market, and his $10 million turned into $2 million, and he committed suicide. Because he lost $8 million. But he had started with one and he had two a year later, but he committed suicide. So the perception of that, the stress of that, the having built himself up, well, there's that narcissistic wound I was talking about. The other crime, the crime to escape judicial punishment, which is what you say, or the dehumanization, or the boredom of incarceration. I mean, geez. Incarceration is not fun, even if you are listening to The Positive Mind, as many people in prison do. We have a big audience out there. Loss of your family, catastrophic injury, substance abuse, an adverse environment can also be, and children, young women who are the result of sexual abuse, consistent sexual abuse, they're very likely to kill themselves or attempt suicide. To avoid shame or dishonor, curiosity. Some people want to know what happens in an afterlife. And in some people, you convince them that the afterlife is so beautiful that they say, all right, well, I'll just go there, like a curiosity. And, of course, political reasons. I'm not sure about the genetic factors in suicide. They did say that there was something about the P factors they seemed to all have in common, that there were ways that people had in common. There was some kind of genetic defect that seemed to enable you to make that thing. Now, suicide and divorce. Divorced or separated men commit suicide 400% more than women. This may be due to a combination of legal and cultural tendencies that favor women in the situation. For example, 85% of protection orders are awarded to female, and only 7% of those petitions are denied. When the father lives outside the house, 40% of the children have no contact with him, so that when a man gets divorced, very often he loses his children and contact with them. So it seems to put him at a higher risk because he is alone, whereas usually the mother stays behind with the children, therefore not putting her at a higher risk. The driving force behind suicide vary across a range of themes. Common intentions behind suicidal actions include guilt, remorse, and provoking of guilt in those left behind. There is this thing about trying to make others pay for what you go through. So one of the things we do in therapy when somebody comes in and talks about this is we try to unmask the anger and aggression that they feel, because they feel so angry, but they feel powerless to do anything about it. When we unmask it, once we show them what it is, they find that they have that they feel a little more power, and they have the anger not turned against themselves.
Well, in the psychological camp, some of the theories that are discussed and are frequently believed. Carl Menninger believed that all suicides had three motivations, three emotions that were interrelated. One was revenge, as you mentioned, depression, and guilt. And then there was Edwin Schneidman, who really had a different point of view. He thought that people who committed suicide had an unbearable psychological pain. And before we were talking about isolation and the perception that death is the only way out of the problem. So it really has two different sides of a coin. One really impacting on the others in the life of the person with who is suicidal or who actually commits suicide, and one who believes that who's really committed to their own discomfort and believes that there's no way out. And so there's no real specific answer to the absolute reason, but there really are many motivations.
I got a question in from Bruce, who asked us a question about hearing that dentists have a high rate of suicide. Do you know about this? Dentists have a high rate of suicide. Psychiatrists have a high rate of suicide. I think among the psychiatrists, Bruce says, how do you account for this? I think among the psychiatrists, they have this feeling that they have power over the mind in one way or another. So I have a feeling that they say to themselves, okay, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Also, anesthesiologists among physicians have a high rate of suicide. In part, dentists, anesthesiologists, and other physicians have access to medications with which they can kill themselves. So if they were having suicidal ideation and if they didn't get help for themselves, they had the tools that they needed to take their lives.
Here's another letter from an old friend, Joe, who said to me, he was depressed and suicidal at one point, and a man called in on our show, and he was a writer like himself. And here's what I said to the guy. I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm a writer. And I would have said it if he was a musician too. But I noticed that he was on the air talking to me, and he had a good language and a good presence. And I said the following to him, you could do anything you want with your life, but you are somebody who has the ability to communicate because you're talking on the phone to me right now. And I feel very alone in this world, having to lead as many people as possible to be teachers. You are a teacher. Almost everyone who has any thought of just ending their life, they're thinking they have no value. But there are so many people who have the potential to teach. You still have a part of you that could reach out to other people and help people. So I said to him, no, I don't want you to leave. I need you on my team. I said, we don't pay a big salary, but I need you here with me, helping us help the people who really need the help. And he turned around, and I remember I'd heard from him later, and he said it made a difference to him. Well, Joe said, it struck a chord with me and put me on a new track in life. Last August, he said, one of his fellow writers committed suicide. No one knew he was depressed. He wanted to thank us for the work we do. Yeah, it's so nice to be able to hear. And we have a number of, oh my God, there are so many letters. There are so many letters from different people. Harry, I would love to get into this, and I see that we're running near the end of time. The end of time. The end of time. Well, it's not the end of time, but this is Armand DeMille. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. Sherry, thank you so much for the courage to take this on with me, because I know so many people would shy away. I love your spirit.
I'm glad you brought it up. It's a really tough subject.
Be back with you, my friends, tomorrow at 1 p.m.
Questions about your computer? Mm-hmm.
Want to know about the latest electronics?
Yeah.
Are you confused by high-definition TV?
A little.
Well, tune into WBAI every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for the Personal Computer Show.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's every Wednesday on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Oh.
So why don't you tell a friend?
Well, okay.
And tell your boss.
Well.
Hey, call your mom and tell them about the Personal Computer Show every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Oh, okay. I got questions about my computer.
Have you got questions about your computer?
Not my coffee over in my keyboard. Do you think that's a problem?
No, not for me.
Well, this doesn't mean we're working right, Jimmy.
I'd buy a new one, you know what I mean.
Okay, but you really have got to be there. It's like the best. It's the Personal Computer Show.
The bell for freedom still rings.
Earthwatch, Transterrestrial Radio with Robert Knight, returns to WBAI Wednesdays at midnight. I'm Robert Knight, inviting you to rejoin us on Earthwatch, a live, freeform radio excursion into space, science, news, politics, metaphysics, music, the arts, and more.
That the man in the moon must have found.
That's Earthwatch, Transterrestrial Radio, Wednesdays at midnight on the new WBAI 99.5 FM. Pacifica Radio in New York.
For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
All right, so that's Earthwatch, Transterrestrial Excursions with Robert Knight. That's coming up later on tonight at midnight. And in fact, I wasn't able to see no one in this metropolitan area because of the inclement weather was able to see Mercury. I understand that Mercury is very visible in the night sky. Perhaps as things clear up around this tri-state area with its closeness to Venus, we'll be able to see Mercury. Anyway, more on that later on tonight on Earthwatch. I'm sure Robert Knight will touch on that and many other things. You are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio, WBAI, in New York at 99.5 FM. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide weekday afternoons, and I want to take a moment to encourage you and direct you to our website, WBAI.org. You can find out a lot of information about the radio station in general and how to contribute to keep this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station on the air. We have fundraising drives for about a couple of times. Would that